Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. In a previous program, I was talking about the things we should avoid and the things that are good for us. And in this program, I'm going to finish that up by telling you a bit about the things you should avoid. Grilled food, disinfectants, bottled water, and perhaps staying up late. We can start off with bottled water because so many people carry those bottles around with them in all activities, wherever they go. Well, bottled water almost always contains microplastics. A study of 259 water bottles from the U.S. and 8 other countries found that 93% were contaminated with pieces of plastic that were less than 5 millimeters long. The researchers found an average of 10 plastic particles per liter of water. They remain unsure, however, of how or when this contamination occurs, or how the plastic in the body affects human health. It's not about pointing fingers at particular brands. It's really showing that this is everywhere and that plastic has become such a pervasive material in our society. Well, looking at disinfectants, here is another recommendation. Disinfectants could make children overweight by altering their gut bacteria. Researchers in Canada found that infants who lived in households where antimicrobial disinfectants were used every week were twice as likely at ages 3 to 4 months to have higher levels of lactospirosis, a gut bacteria which is linked to animal studies in increased levels of body fat and insulin resistance. By age 3, those children were more likely to be overweight or obese than other kids from homes where surface cleaners and other disinfectants were not used as regularly. And then there's grilled food. We've been told to go easy on grilled food for many years. But more recent research tells us that grilled food may indeed increase the risk for high blood pressure. Harvard researchers analyzed the diets of some 103,000 people for 16 years. Those who ate grilled, broiled, or roasted meats or fish more than 15 times a month were 17% more likely to develop high blood pressure than were people who ate them fewer than 4 times a month. Participants who preferred their meats well done were 15% more likely to suffer hypertension than those who opted for rarer meats. Lead researcher Gong Liu says that chemicals produced by cooking meats at high temperatures induce oxidative stress, inflammation, and insulin resistance in animals, possibly leading to a raised risk, of developing high blood pressure. And finally, one that we may or may not be ready to accept, and that is staying up late. We're told now that staying up late could reduce your lifespan. Researchers tracked 430,000 adults for nearly 7 years and found that the night owls had a 10% greater risk of early death than those who woke early. People who burned the midnight oil were also more likely to have chronic health issues, such as diabetes, neurological disorders, and respiratory disease. Study author Kristen Knutson says those naturally inclined to rise late feel pressure to conform to other people's schedules, leaving them anxious and sleep deprived. There's a problem for the night owl who's trying to live in the morning lark world, she says. And that is what we should avoid. And we're going on now to the next topic after this brief musical interlude. What caused the California fires this year? Scientists expect wildfire seasons to lengthen, with blazes becoming even more severe. The devastation from the wildfires in California this year is unprecedented. Some experts are calling for a retooled approach, given the increasing destructiveness and the fact that more people live where the fires occur. The question is, what has happened? The past year or so has been one of the most devastating in California's history. Of the 20 most destructive fires on record in the state, 7 of them have occurred since October 2017. Fires in 2018 have included the Mendocino Complex fire, by far California's largest wildfire on record, and the Camp Fire, which is the deadliest and the most destructive in state history. The Camp Fire, which is 80% contained as of this writing in early December, has destroyed about 12,600 homes. At least 81 people died and 870 were missing. California Governor Jerry Brown called the fires, which have resulted in billions of dollars in damage, the state's new abnormal. Unfortunately, the best science is telling us that dryness, warmth, drought, all of these things are going to intensify. President Trump has blamed the fires on poor forest management at the state level. Is he right? Well, not really. Many of the fires that started were in shrublands, not forests. What's more, of California's 33 million acres of forest, some 40% is privately owned, and about 60% is managed by federal and not state officials. Just 3% is managed by state or local agencies. If homes are burning down, it's not a public land issue. It's a private land issue, and it has nothing to do with forest management, says Jennifer Bach, who is a fire ecologist at the University of Boulder in Colorado. Just what role does climate change play? According to scientists, a big one. Warmer temperatures in the spring and summer increase the likelihood of a longer wildfire season in the western United States. The same conditions increase the chances that fires will be hotter and they will burn for a longer period once they begin. Climate change plays a fundamental role in changing what our fire situation is, according to Professor Bach. We see 5 times more large fires today than we did in the 1970s. As Earth continues to warm, scientists expect wildfire seasons to lengthen, with blazes becoming more severe. Research suggests that as fuels have become 50% drier since the 1980s, the number of fires has doubled. Are there other factors that could have played a role? Scientists say the so-called Diablo wind, which parches vegetation of its moisture and feeds flames with oxygen, is a driving force behind the fires in the northern part of the state, including the Camp Fire. The high winds are produced by the jet stream. The fast-moving but meandering river of wind in the upper atmosphere that creates a low-pressure zone off California's coast and a high-pressure zone over the land. This makes the winds blow west. They pick up speed as they flow over the Sierra Nevada. The winds have confounded some efforts to use planes or helicopters to combat the fires. Also, winds blowing from the campfire dramatically worsened air quality in many towns in Northern California. As for fires in Southern California, including the Woolsey Fire, Santa Ana winds were a major factor. These seasonal winds are not unlike the Diablo wind. They're dry and hot. But in the southern part of the state, the fires have been closer to the coast, which means the winds can carry the smoke out to sea, in contrast to the north. Just what are some of the ways to make fires less harmful? A growing number of experts are suggesting that the traditional approach to try to extinguish all the fires is not sustainable. We tried that experiment for 100 years and it didn't work, according to Professor Balk. Instead, many fire ecologists recommend reducing combustible home building materials, and in Balk's words, actively managing the fuels in and around where people are living. The key is getting this done on a broad scale. The biggest danger to your home is when your neighbor's home goes up in flames, according to experts. The shift that needs to happen is a shift toward mandatory adherence to regulations, passing regulations that are enforced and done at a landscape scale. That's still very rare in the West. But San Diego is a notable exception. Every 2 years, the city inspects more than 42,000 at-risk properties in order to ensure that owners manage vegetation with 100 feet of their homes. Another community that emphasizes prevention is Flagstaff, Arizona, which requires all homes to use flame-retardant materials. In addition, the city approved a $10 million bond to do targeted fuel reduction around the town. A few years after that approval, when a fire broke out and was headed toward Flagstaff, it hit the thinned-out understory and burned itself out. Flagstaff was able to protect itself. One of the questions that many people would like answered is, how did Saudi Arabia become our ally? When did the alliance begin? Has it ever wavered? Is the image true? What's in it for the U.S.? And has President Trump affected the relationship? Let's begin with the first question. When did the alliance start? Relationship goes back to the late 1930s, just after Abdul Aziz ibn Saud consolidated the squabbling Arab tribes into a kingdom. U.S. energy companies had discovered oil in the Arabian Peninsula and had asked their government to promote their interests with the new monarch. In 1945, President Franklin Roosevelt met with King Abdul Aziz aboard a U.S. ship in the Suez Canal, and the two got along famously. FDR gave the ailing king one of his own wheelchairs, which the king later called his most precious possession. FDR succeeded in ensuring that the U.S., and not the British, would control Saudi oil. And in return, the U.S. would provide security for the kingdom. Within a few years, a U.S. military base was set up near the oil fields. Over the decades, the oil for security arrangement became vital to both countries. Saudi Arabia is now the U.S. defense industry's largest foreign consumer, buying some $112 billion worth of weapons during the Obama administration alone. Well, has this alliance ever wavered? If you remember back in 1973, the oil embargo was a major rough patch. For a year, the Saudis quit selling to the U.S. in retaliation for our support of Israel in the Yom Kippur War. But the two countries made up. They united in opposition to the Soviet Union. Even the 9/11 attacks couldn't loosen the bond. Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and 15 of the 19 hijackers who flew planes into the World Trade Center and Pentagon were Saudi nationals, and U.S. public opinion turned strongly against the kingdom after Saudi citizens were allowed to leave the U.S. right after the attack and before the FBI could interview them. President George W. Bush had family who had long-standing Saudi business relationships stood by the alliance, and in 2005, he was photographed holding hands with the then Crown Prince Abdullah. In the decade after 9/11, the Saudis spent more than $100 million in public relations attempts trying to overcome the country's image as an exporter of terrorism. Well, is that image true? Decades ago, the Saudi monarchy made a tacit bargain with radical Islamists in the country. It would fund the spread of Wahhabism, the Saudi form of ultra-conservative Islam, and jihadism around the world, as long as the radicals did not blow up targets inside of Saudi Arabia. Saudi money funded Islamist militants in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bosnia, and the Russian province of Chechnya. After 2011, Saudi officials claimed to have turned off the money spigot, but secret U.S. diplomatic cables, which were published in WikiLeaks in 2009, said that Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the Pakistani terrorist group Lashkar-e-Taiba, and the Palestinian terrorist group Hamas, giving them millions of dollars annually. Well, what is in it for the U.S., this alliance between the two countries? Saudi's oil, of course, although last year it made up only 9% of what the U.S. used because of our fracking revolution. More strategically important today is the Saudis' regional role as a counterbalance to Iran. Ever since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, when Iranian mullahs took U.S. diplomats hostage, the U.S. has seen Iran as the most dangerous actor in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, which practices Sunni Islam, opposes the Iranian Shiites' theocracy, proxy interventions in other Middle Eastern countries, including Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen. More recently, the Saudis have begun working with America's other major regional ally, Israel, because both countries see Iran as an existential threat to the area. Just how has Trump affected this relationship? The president has long-standing business ties with the Saudis by his own account. He's sold them millions of dollars worth of real estate. And he says, "Am I supposed to dislike them?" he asked while campaigning for president. "I like them very much." Well, since taking office, he has made the Saudi alliance a priority. His first foreign trip out of the U.S. was to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia's capital. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, quickly grew close to one of the king's sons, Mohammed bin Salman, and the administration strongly supported Mohammed's elevation to crown prince last year. They viewed him as a reformer, intent on modernizing his country. Congress, on the other hand, is not so enamored. The killing of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, last month, prompted the Senate to invoke the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act. And this requires the president to identify within 4 months which Saudis should be sanctioned. "In moments like this, you have to embrace your values," said Senator Lindsey Graham. "No more transactional interactions." Thank you. Noted in the news this week, actually in the Week magazine, it was back in November, white supremacists and other members of far white movements were responsible for 71% of extremist-related deaths in the U.S. between 2008 and 2017. Islamic extremists were responsible for 26%. The number of terrorist incidents in the U.S. has tripled since 2013, most of them being driven by anti-Muslim, anti-Semitic, anti-government, or racist ideologies. And that is a good place for me to stop today. Thank you for being with me. See you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.